What we find is, in the book, I spent a lot of time comparing the effectiveness of different reward-based methods, but also of using aversive punishment, because it's often billed as, oh, it's a quick fix, you know, for red-line dogs, difficult cases. And what I proved was it's neither quick nor a fix. And when you compare it to lure reward training for dealing with these same problems, pulling on leash, jumping up, barking, lure reward training using a single word is far more effective because it conveys two pieces of information. Stop what you're doing and do this instead.
Welcome to the Pet Care Report podcast by Pet Summits. Here's your dog training host, Melissa Vieira.
Hello, and welcome back to the Pet Care Report. I'm excited to be joined today by one of the leading voices in the world of dog training, Dr. Ian Dunbar. Dr. Dunbar's work has been influential for dog trainers everywhere. He is the founder of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers, as well as the author to numerous best-selling books. Today, he joins us to talk about his latest book, Barking Up the Right Tree, as well as lure reward training. So thank you so much, Dr. Ian Dunbar, for joining us today. Can we get started by talking a little bit about lure reward training and what that is?
Certainly, but first, good to see you again. It's been much too long.
I agree. Thank you.
Well, lure reward training is, I mean, there's half a dozen different reward-based training techniques, and some of them just observe and reward the whole thing, like you wait for the dog to sit or you wait for him to stop barking. So I used to call that all or none reward training. Now we call it wait and reward. Or Joel Walton had a lovely name for it because the acronym, it's simply observe and reward. And because the acronym is SOAR, which I really like, I'm jealous about. Or you reward progressive steps of the behavior, like in shaping. Then we have auto shaping, which is just, it's automatic. You set it up and the dog trains himself. So, you know, there's many different types. But lure reward training I love because it is designed to do two things. To, from the outset, teach dogs ESL, or English as a second language. So from the outset, it puts the behaviors on cue. So when we're teaching sit, down, stand, come, heel, the dog is learning to do it on cue rather than the process of capturing the behavior. Then we have to go through a more difficult process of putting the word on cue because we don't know when the dog's going to do it. And of course, for the association to be made to the request or the command, as they used to call it, depends on that coming first. Well, the beauty of reward training is we lure the behavior we want. So we use a toy lure or a food lure. It's very convenient for first time, you know, doggy owners. And so we say, Rover, sit, then we lure it to sit with a piece of food. And with a piece of food, you lure pretty much anything you want the dog to do in basic manners. Come, sit, lie down, roll over, sit up from the down, stand, heel, sit when you stop, or walk by your side. So it's a ideal way to start for dog owners. The other wonderful thing about lure reward training, which is unlike any other reward-based technique, that formalized into the process is phasing out your training tools, notably food lures. That's in step one. And then in step two, we don't phase them out entirely, but we reduce the number because so many people use much too much food. So you're devaluing it. It's reinforcing value. And so we really thin out food rewards and make room for much more powerful rewards, like, you know, life rewards, go sniff, go play, or interact games with people, fetch, tug, hide and seek. And then my favorite rewards are what most people call behavior problems. Well, I think if we put them on cue, like speak. Well, then we can yo-yo, speak and shush. And what's the reward for shushing? You tell him, speak again. Or jazz up, settle down. What's the reward for settling down? You tell him to jazz up again. So here we really meet the dog more than halfway, because we let them be a dog just on our terms. We just teach them, you know, fetch what, or, you know, when to bark, when to stop barking. So we basically let them know when are the most appropriate times to be a dog, because sometimes I'm really inappropriate, you know, like peeing or barking or acting the fool, you know. But when we have them on cue, we can choose times to have a barkathon or a crazy session, you know, or to fetch something, or obviously to go pee on cue. Well, now you're empty, so now we can play with the dog inside because you're playing with an empty dog. So I love lure reward training because it's quick. It's the quickest way, bar none, to get behaviors on cue and teach the dogs our language, ESL, you know, English as a second language, so we can give very clear instructions now prior to task. The dog knows what we want it to do. But more importantly, we can give instructive guidance when dogs go off the straight and narrow. And so what it means is, and this is actually the jewel in the crown of the whole book, that when you use verbal guidance, when dogs, you know, bark or pull on leash or whatever, the jump up, whatever they're doing that's annoying the owner, you just calmly use your voice. You don't have to raise it. You just say, Rover, sit. Rover, shush. And what we find is, in the book, I spent a lot of time comparing the effectiveness of different reward-based methods, but also of using aversive punishment, because it's often billed as, oh, it's a quick fix, you know, for red-line dogs, difficult cases. And what I proved was it's neither quick nor a fix. And when you compare it to lure reward training for dealing with these same problems, pulling on leash, jumping up, barking, lure reward training using a single word is far more effective because it conveys two pieces of information. Stop what you're doing and do this instead. You know? And so it changes the whole relationship that now people aren't being forced to do what they obviously know is wrong to frighten or hurt their dog. And poof, we get rid of aversive punishments. Well, aversive stimuli, because if they don't work, we can't call them punishments, can we? Because they're defined by their effect on behavior. And if it doesn't have the intended effect, then it cannot by definition be defined as a punishment.
Can we break this up a little bit for somebody who might not have any experience training a dog? Maybe they're a new pet owner. What actually is the lure, and how do they determine what the reward is for their individual dog?
Well, I usually start, you know, everyone in puppy class off using food lures. And since we have food lures, using the food as a reward too. But then we quickly have to phase out the food lure, because if you're presenting food prior to the task, prior to the behavior, it's in great danger of becoming a bribe. So when we're using the same thing, food as a lure to teach the dog what we want it to do, and a reward to teach the dog why do it, you know, to motivate the dog to want to do it. That is probably the biggest Achilles heel for a lot of people. And most people who use food, no matter what reward-based technique they're using, it's become a bribe. And now they're presenting it beforehand, you know, in their hand, or whether they've got a great big bait bag in front of them, you know, with half a pound of treats in it or whatever. And that's very different. And so I get rid of the food lure very quickly because we teach hand signals. You see, it's a two-step process, learning the meaning of the verbal cue. First, they learn hand signals, which is so easy for dogs. So food in our hand, if we go sit, down, after about six trials with a border collie, we just go Rover. And it sits. because hand signals is one of the dog's languages, you know, body language, and they pick it up so quickly. So then we have no food in our hand. So now we're going, Rover, sit. Rover, down. Rover, roll over. Yeah, Rover, shush. And so it's very, extremely easy, though, to phase out food as a reward. And you must not phase out food as a reward because it's nice giving. I like giving the odd treat to a dog just for being there. Well, I say just for being there. That's the most important thing, isn't it? They're here with us still and they're lying by our side or looking at us or whatever they're doing. I don't mind. I'd rather be with a dog than without a dog. So I'd rather have a dog that's misbehaving than one that's die, you know, and that happens much too soon, of course, is another part of my book. So the lure, though, we can, another way to do it is we can replace it with a toy, like a tug toy or a tennis ball. So I like a small tug tennis ball. So we say, Rover, sit. And the dog will do anything for a tennis ball, anything. So then we can say, good dog, praise. As a reward, or give a food reward. And we won't get this danger that the food will become a bribe because the food only comes after the behavior. And I like to hide it. I mean, I'll hide it all over the house, on the mantelpiece, on shelves, in books, you know, behind a pillow. So I wash my hands, no food on me. I back up, you know, Feeny, come here. And when she comes, good dog. And I reach for the mantelpiece and give her a food reward. I mean, once I told this story in the book as well. I went down to the park before her walk and I hid treats in a tree. So she knows I have no food, but she gave me a really nice recall, quick sit, lots of attention. So I say, oh, Feeny, so good. And I reached up to the tree branch and gave her a liver treat, a freeze-dried liver treat. I mean, it blew her cotton-picking mind.
Right. Isn't that great? Because then they look at you like, how did you know that was there?
Magic.
Right.
It's a huge thing about rewards that to the dog, it should appear that they've come by magic. If they've been promised, as in the contract with bribing, if you'll only sit and look at me, I'll give you food. Well, the dog may do it now, but it doesn't mean to say he'll do it in the future. And so they may be reliable. I say may because sometimes they're not. But the effect is not permanent. Whereas when you're conditioning with a food reward, when used appropriately, it increases the frequency of the immediately preceding behavior such that it's more likely to occur in the future. So that's a major part of the definition of reward. It's changing future behavior in terms of the dog's inclination to do what you ask, the dog's motivation, if you like.
And what kinds of things can be trained with a lure that people might not realize?
I mean, all the any behavior that we want for basic manners, I would just lure reward train it. The one exception is if I get to the owner too late and the food has already become a bribe. So then I switch to wait and reward training. And actually, I'm just watching my videos. We're really revamping DunbarAcademy.com. So I'm watching videos filmed in the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s. And the last one I watched, I thought, wow, this is such a great video. Because the way I explain it, and these are all adult dogs, and a lot of them are hopeless. They've totally been bribed. And you see the owner, even with sort of medium-trained dogs, they've got food, and they're going like this, like they're trying to get the food to get the dog's chin up to look at them, you know. And it's a total bribe. So I say, forget that. We're just going to watch the dog, and we're only going to reward it when it does something we like. Now, for me, the number one good behavior is no bad behavior, or good and bad are not the right words, but say desirable, undesirable. Because I say to people, praise your dog. And they say, why? He's not doing anything. I say, precisely. He's not barking. He's not growling. He's not jumping up. He's not chasing his tail. He's not humping the cat. He's just minding his own business. So be a part of that business. And say, good dog. And so if we look at the old acronym LEMA, after writing my book, you know, and that means least invasive, minimally aversive. First, I would say, no, non-aversive. You know, I'm showing that basic reward training is more effective than any aversive stimulus. Certainly an aversive stimulus will inhibit behavior, but is that what we want? Do we want to inhibit the dog from being a dog or acting like a dog? No. We want to teach him how to act like a dog when living with people. And there's times when it's appropriate, there's situations when it's appropriate and not, you know, where to pee, what to chew, when to pee, when to bark, for how long to bark. But the least invasive part, I don't know why they ever came up with that. I mean, what sort of training are you doing if you want it to be least invasive? I want it to be totally invasive and non-aversive. I want Tina, not Lima. I want to be absolutely inside the dog's brain to the same extent I want the dog in my brain. I want to mind meld like on Star Trek, you know? I'm not doing anything nasty. Like this use of the word invasive is very, very negative. And so, you know, I want to, when the dog's just minding his own business, I want to be a part of that and let him know, I'm really happy with you now. Because you're lying down, you're daydreaming. It makes me happy. But, hey, I'm coming into your daydreams now. Hey, this is Ian. This is Daddy. Dad is here, you know. And so it's, I think, dog training absolutely needs a makeover now. It's just, it's gone in the wrong direction. I don't know what's happened since 2004. I mean, the 80s and 90s and the first half of the century, it was brilliant. So I'm pulling out all these videos of this is how we did adult classes. Come in, let them off leash. Why? Because they'd been socialized. You can't do that now. You've got growly dogs, barky dogs, dogs out of control. And so all this adult dog training I did back then and all the games we played, in the canine games, you know, we would have 72 dogs, adult dogs, and these are dog owners' dogs. They aren't trainers' dogs. I would only allow one trainer per team because they ruin the whole thing. They get too competitive. These are dog owners with their dogs off leash. We had Malamutes. I remember once we had four Bulbuls. You know, there were seven in the workshop, but four were playing in the games. I mean, these are enormous dogs, but they were so friendly because as a breed, they're so easy to socialize, but people don't socialize them now. You know, in England, they're banning the latest breed ban was these extra large pit bulls. It just happened last month. I think, what is up with you, you stupid dog professions? You, whether you're a breeder or a veterinarian or pet store person or humane society, you should be telling everyone the most important variable is whether it was socialized or not prior to 8 weeks of age or 3 months of age. And then you can train them any time in your life and you don't have to deal with fear. We wouldn't need fear-free because the dogs aren't afraid of people now. You can act like a person. You can do your job as a vet. You know, because the dog's kind of cool with it.
One thing that you did mention that I think ties really nicely into the lower reward training is the games. So, of course, you did the canine games, which we can certainly talk a little bit more about that. But I think games in general and just the way lower reward training is a little bit lighter. It's really, I mean, the technique is you can teach pet owners who have no experience. So it's just kind of that light and fun. And I think that ties nicely into games. And you were talking a little bit about that. Would you agree with that, that that is one of the reasons the method is effective?
Well, of course. You know, playing games is fun. But aside from the fun factor, there's two very important things about tricks and games. One is that most of probably about six of the first 10 tricks we teach a dog, like, you know, high five, shake hands, roll over, play dead, are all friendly appeasement gestures. So, you know, some people say, oh, you're just teaching a stupid trick. Yeah, what I'm actually doing is asking for the dog to act friendly on cue so that when I'm walking my dog, I can put this other owner and dog at ease coming towards me. Because you see straight away, this owner, they see my, you know, I've always had big dogs apart from Hugo, who was a French bulldog, you know, Malamutes and, you know, American bulldogs and stuff like that. And yeah, if you don't know them, that can be a little off-putting. And as soon as you show fear, your dog will catch it. So now your dog's getting a little reactive. Well, now my dog looks at you and that dog totally losing it. So my dog gets a little scared. So I have to calm him down. And the way I do it is I take a step back and I say, you know, come here, just one step. Come here, sit, watch. And so now what the other dog and owner see is my dog's rear end wagging. And if they're really upset, with Phoenix, I would say, be a bear. And she would do this, you know, and they laugh. And instantly their dog's now relieved. And so now my dogs, oh, thank goodness, you know, they're friendly because they were freaking out, man. I don't know what I was going to meet. So this is a means for owners to make it easier on their own dog when walking, because they can put other dogs at ease rather than just blaming the other dog. Oh, this owner, you know, stupid, had no control over a dog, shouldn't be walking it, and the dog, it should be muzzled. Instead of saying that, they see a dog now, an owner who's laughing and skipping along the road or walking jauntily, and that dog is all waggy butt and stuff. So that really helps. The other reason for teaching games, it accelerates training ridiculously. I mean, in the book, I mean, a lot of people are saying, why are you caring about speed and ease? Well, I look at three, I take it that if we are talking training, of course it's fun. I don't even get into this humane issue. You know, what I do is fun. Well, is fun not humane? I think it is. I have fun with dogs. I'm mess around. So I when I look at different training techniques, whether different reward techniques or using aversive stimuli, I want to ask, did it work? If it did, well, because if it didn't work, you can't say you're a dog trainer and you can't say you're using an aversive punishment. By definition, it's just aversive. It's not a punishment, you know, if it doesn't have the intended effect on behavior. So first, is it effective? Second, how quickly is it effective? And then how easy was it for the owners? So why does training have to be quick and easy, right? It's obvious why it has to be effective. Otherwise, it's not training. And we're not having a discussion about training. We're arguing about the personality of this trainer who you don't like. And you say they're horrible. They're doing horrible things. They're being inhumane. No, this is a discussion about whether you think something is inhumane or not. And I love those discussions. And I have very interesting views on what's humane. And the biggest one is that the dog's quality of life through life is always improving rather than the quality of life is getting worse. Why? Because you didn't teach it to shush on cue and to pee on cue. And so now he's peeing in the house and barking, so he gets confined. So you gave him full run of the house, and now you're closing it down until he's confined to the yard or to the basement or to one room when visitors come round, because you didn't socialize him to love unfamiliar people. And you don't walk him because now your dog's reactive because you don't know how to make other dogs less reactive. So your dog's always in a world of reactive dogs. So of course your dog gets reactive. So we close down now its freedom and its quality of life gets worse and worse. And I think that's really cruel. I think that's really inhumane. Or then you send it to a shelter. You see, it goes from the yard to the basement to a shelter often. But training, I assume it's fun. And if it's not, then you've got in the look in the mirror and lighten up and brighten up. But I look at, is it effective? Obviously. Is it quick? Is it easy? If it's not easy, it's usually beyond the means of most new dog owners out there. So like shaping is a very complicated reward-based training technique. It needs a lot of experience, a lot of expertise, And there's barely half a dozen people on the planet as good as Bob Bailey. I'm sorry, man. He's the king. And I know a number of people who are shaping aficionados who are probably as good at, if not better than Bob now, because they're much younger. When you get to Bob and my age, you lose a lot of your chops and your timing and stuff. So it's got to be simple, okay? But then it's got to be quick. Why? Otherwise, owners may not put in enough time. You know, they used to say, oh, to train, you got to be consistent and you got to put in the time. And I say, no, you don't. You don't have to put in the time if you lure reward train. It's so quick. I mean, we start off in the very first exercise. Come here, sit down, sit up, stand down, stand up. That's seven different behaviors on our very first trial. And we work from there. We're teaching so much in the first class because you have to wow the owner like, wow, this class is incredible. Man, I needed this 4 weeks ago. Well, they should have gone to our Zoom kindergarten classes then, you know, to see what we do. So it has to be quick, and you don't have to be consistent. This is a biggie. Like all this, you know, whenever you see a trainer on the radio, you know, it's time to the second, and the host would say, well, 10 seconds left, training, one word, or training, three words. And the first word out of the trainer's mouth was always consistency. Well, only if you're using aversive stimuli. You have to be consistent, otherwise the dog won't learn what you want, but he'll learn when you can't punish him. You know, home alone problems or off-leash problems. No, with reward training, you shouldn't be consistent. So why are we talking about all of these reinforcement schedules that require consistency? And even if we had, you know, I wouldn't even talk about continuous schedules or fixed schedules. They just don't exist in my training routine. Ah, I like the variable schedules. Problem is, people can't compute them because they're pre-computed. You know, it's very difficult to be totally random. So I come up with, you know, when using rewards, well, try to be as random as possible, which is impossible because humans can't generate random numbers. But I'll tell you what, right before you reward, have a sort of a veto. You know, like, that was worth a reward. No, it wasn't. Wow. You have suddenly magnified the reinforcing value of that reward because the dog now can't predict whether it's coming or not. It's magical. It's out of the tree. And when you add that magical component, I call it, you have like an ineffable veto. Like, I think I'm going to reward. I haven't given a reward for a long time, but no, it wasn't really good enough. This deliberation, like you're a judge on America's Got Talent, really gets the dog cued in. Like, am I going to get a reward? The hand went in the pocket. Oh, my word, it came out without a food reward. He's going to have so much more intention and engagement going on, and then all of a sudden he'll throw a behavior at you, which you, in an eye blink, because we're human, we're not a computer in a laboratory experiment, we can say, that was just priceless. It was fantastic. And this is how I reward the dog, with adjectives. I like to use three new adjectives I've never used today with the reward, and I linger over them like, you are the best dog in the entire world. That's worth 10 treats. But I don't have 10, so I'm going to give you one. But it's worth 10. You know, training has lost its voice. Come on. Very few people give instructions beforehand. That's why we lure reward train. So I can speak to my dog in a sentence. Feeny, come here, sit, take this, find Jamie, please. And so the dog runs off around the house, out to the garden, and sits in front of Jamie to deliver. We used to call it Malamute Mail. The whole point of teaching words is so we can give an instruction in a sentence. But the big disaster that's only happened in the last two decades, we've lost praise. I mean, for some people, it's reduced to a food treat. To other people, to just a click and a food treat. This is insanity when you think, this is my best friend. this is my dog. And I want to tell him how good he is and how I'm looking after a dog at the moment because the owners are in hospital having a baby and they had to go back to hospital. So I woke up feeling 3 days ago so depressed. I'm working so hard at the moment, you know, and I think, oh, God, I've got another day at this. I got to get this right, our website. And then I thought, oh, I got to walk Bomi. And I jumped out of bed. I didn't even take a shower. I put clothes on. I went out and I went and got Bomi, who was just wiggling. I mean, this is a Korean Jindo, for goodness sake. They never show emotion. And the dog can't contain himself. And because he's had a 12-hour break, you know, I don't want him to wiggle so much. He's dripping urine places. I said, come on, let's get outside quickly, put on the leash, and off he went. I said, go pee, Bomi. Did an enormous long pee. And then I said, Bomi, I got to tell you, thank you. I feel so different about my day, all because I saw your wiggles. You know, and I don't expect him to understand what I'm saying, but he gets the emotion and the tone, but it's gone from training. So many trainers are like,
right.
Yes. Treat. It drives me crazy. Show some emotion to the dog, you know?
Well, just in the last 30 minutes, you've mentioned toys, treats, praise, hiding food, different ways of feeding. So there's just so many options and so much unpredictability there, and it keeps the dogs really interested.
You know what, though? I didn't finish what I said. I said there's two great reasons to teach tricks. One, they're friendly appeasement gestures. The other one is, here's a great trick. So puppy class, right? I say, right, for the week, next week, we're going to have a competition. The winner will win this ribbon. Okay? I show them a little ribbon, and they're blue with gold writing on. I said, for the dog that can balance a piece of kibble on his nose for the longest. They come back, and the winner, once I remember, it's a little boy, 2 minutes and so many seconds. I mean,
that's pretty advanced.
Said, well, pretty damn good. So yeah. I said, here's your ribbon. And he beat his dad, which made me happy too. I said, can you read to the class what it says on the ribbon? And the little boy, he's about 9. He says, yeah. He says, serious puppy training, longest sit stay. Can you remember? I said, right, homework for the week is stays. No one would do anything, but you play a stupid trick or a game and they'll do anything to win a little ribbon, but they've now got a 2-minute sit stay. That's the reason for tricks and games in training. It goes to a different level. They're coming to class to have fun, and they leave class with a different dog after just 60 minutes or 55 minutes. A different dog because he's learned so much in class, because now they're integrating teaching and training into living with the dog because they want to do the tricks in class. I love them. I love them. Every time I tell them about that and all the other tricks I do, you know, I ask them to do, I just grin because I know no amount of explaining and pleading would get them to do their homework. They just don't do it.
Well, I also like you talked about how quick you can train new behaviors with the low reward method. And that is important for people now more than ever to be able to see those results really quickly. Like you said, in one class, they're training sit down, they're training multiple things so quickly, and that keeps them motivated as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is where I should say then what is the biggest pro of shaping or clicker training, most people call it. You see, you can only lure behaviors that are in the dog's normal behavior repertoire. And, you know, like stand on his hind legs or stand on his front legs to pee. Cape hunting dogs do that. So you're only working with all the behaviors, gross movements of the body and facial expressions and stuff like that. So it's very easy to lure those. But if the behavior does not exist in the repertoire, like say you want a dog to pirouette on its hind legs backwards, you've got to shape it.
Right.
Or the reason I promoted shaping so heavily at the beginning was because the very first time that clickers were used to train dogs in a workshop, Kathleen Chin put on the workshop and no one signed up because dog trainers thought, what is this silly technique? So I said, well, let me advertise it, because we had massive databases back then. And I said, hey, here's a workshop, a quick and fun way to teach non-retrieving dogs to retrieve. Off leash, no fear, no pain. And that's why I pushed it, because the force retrieve was not occasional. It was default.
Yeah.
In the kennel obedience clubs and in the working dog clubs, it was default, and it was excruciatingly wrong.
And this is when obedience, probably a lot of the participants were competitive obedience students, I'm guessing.
Yeah, but they caught on very quickly, as did Schutzen, who was the first working dog activity, because lure reward training meant points. It meant reliability, you see, because if you're teaching a vocabulary and you're cueing behaviors and responses, if you like, with words, it's very easy now to check for reliability. You see, so for example, I have an index called the response reliability percentage. So it's a percentage of the likelihood, if you said sit, that the dog would sit. So it's based on how many times did the dog sit when asked, and how many commands or hand signals did you have to use? So it works out a percentage. So now you can test and what's standard for most dogs. Let's say a pretty good trained dog. And from watching a lot of videos of trainers over the last 2 weeks, for a lot of trainers, the best reliability is in the kitchen at mealtime. Let's say 50, 60, 70%. It's not 100. It's not even 95, which is what it really should be if you're a trainer. But then we move into the living room, it drops about 10 percentage points. If you go out to your yard, you drop 25 percentage points. If you go onto the street with a dog on leash, you drop about 10, 15 points. If you're off leash in a dog park, well, for a lot of people, it's zeroed out. So now we have an index which is easier to check, because all the behaviors are cued. We know what the reliability is before we let the dog off leash in a dog park or on a trail, or off leash walking from house to the car. Very common. It's one of the most common situations for dogs to be run over. Oh, but he never did that. Well, he did today. A cat was across the street, or a squirrel, and your dog went. And number one, you didn't say anything. You just screamed. Well, that would make me run from you faster if I were the dog. But you didn't say sit. But I mean, if you said sit, have you proofed it there? Yeah, I was watching videos. It's in, we filmed it on August 2008. I remember it's one of my favorite films. Jamie was the cameraman, and he produced such footage of me proofing Dune at the end of the driveway. And it's, I do frighten him a little at the end, but it's a setup. Once I've trained him, he must not cross this line without sitting beforehand, me giving the instruction, let's go, and then immediately sitting when you're on the sidewalk. You know, it's three cues before you cross this line. So I do this, and, you know, walking quickly to the boundary and then going, sit. Really quickly, like this, like it's an emergency. Then I set him up. I just walk really quickly straight out into the street. Well, I know he's going to follow. And as soon as he puts one paw over that line, I go, back, sit. Oh, my God. And I imagine he's been hit by a car and smashed to smithereens. And it comes out in my voice, oh, my God, and the dog's like, what have we done? I say, it's okay, you're sitting, good dog, oh, good dog. Then we go back, do it again. I run, he sits, my arms pulled backwards out of socket. He won't cross that line. So, yeah, once I made it a little scary, but that's proofing my training. And we think that it actually saved Hugo's life once when we had visitors and they left the front gate open. And when they came in, they didn't shut the front door. And I guess Hugo went out to pee. Then they shut, front door's open and shut it. So now he's outside in the courtyard and all the fun's indoors. Well, he hears the fun in the kitchen. So he comes around to the back door. There's an 18-inch strip, not a sidewalk, but it's not the street. It's a curb where you can go from front door to the driveway at the back. And there he was ringing, poochie bells at the back door. And so, it can be taught so quickly with lure reward training. And it was the flavor of the month all through the 80s, 90s. And then it gradually got replaced by other techniques, which take forever and are very complicated.
Well, I think one of the fascinating things about your work, of course, there are many fascinating things, but one of those is that you do test everything. So you say it's effective, but you're not just saying that. You actually test the dogs and you...
And you, of all the interviewers I've had, you and Jamie know that more than most because you're actually now testing response reliability percentages. And as soon as you learn to do that, it's amazing what things will take your training and just obliterate it.
Yeah.
Stimuli that shouldn't even be scary for a dog. For Hugo, it was an 18-inch stone elf in Calistoga. He lost it, man. And this was a highly socialized dog, but there's never any dog that is totally bomb-proof. Never any person. There'll always be things that spook it. And at that point, all the training, the cortex doesn't work anymore. The dog's working for some primordial level. And he went crazy over this 18-inch elf. We're saying, Hugo, it's okay. Hugo, sit. Hugo, sit. He didn't know what the words meant. And it took us about, 4 or 5 minutes, I think. And then we walked back and forth the elf, and our Hugo was back again with his trained cortex. So that's the neat thing about when you learn how to come up with this score, which is so easy to interpret because it's a percentage of combined comprehension and motivation. So it's testing two things: for certain that your dog understands what you want it to do, but also how motivated is the dog to do it in this scenario, like around squirrels or when he's humping another dog or what have you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, now is the time now to get these little research studies out there because you will be the first. It'll be you and a lady in England who's never done this kind of research on dog training before because it solves so many arguments, I find for each trainer, there's a different training technique, right? There's as many training techniques as we have trainers. And they tend to disagree a lot or argue. And if it comes to the notion of, is this inhumane, it gets vitriolic on both sides. And that shouldn't be. That argument shouldn't exist within a profession where we're all trying to do the same thing, which is teaching owners how to teach their dogs. Or even teaching dogs to compete with them. But this eliminates arguments because we say, right, here's another routine to do. What I want you to do is to go sit, stand, down, stand, sit, stand, down, stand. I'm going to time you. You got to train the dog to do that. But I'm going to give you a percentage reliability for each separate response. Sit, stand, sit, stand. Down, stand, down, stand. Okay, so it's very different standing whether the dog's sitting or lying down. And sit is very different. If the dog's standing, it's easy. If it's lying down, it's harder on big breeds. Well, down is much harder from the stand to teach than from the sit. And a lot of people, when they can't get a dog that's standing or walking to lie down, they go, sit. Down. It's like, God, you used all these commands where one word down, would have worked. And so now we don't have arguments. And once the research starts to come out, you're kind of making a statement this is what happened. For better or worse, this is what we did. Duplicate it and do better. Why? Then I'll listen to you. If you can't do as well as we did, then shut up. Because you've got nothing to say to me, because I'm training dogs quicker and more effectively than you are. So this levels the playing field now, and we know if someone has, say, a crazy training technique, and there are some really, really crazy ones out there where I think, how on earth did you think that up? I mean, it's hard enough. How did they make training so boring and so horrible?
Well, even just for pet owners training their own dogs, it's important. Of course, for trainers, it's really important for us to be testing what we're doing. But pet owners, they can test, do their cues work? If they test a verbal or a signal, is it actually working? Or is the dog just watching a small movement or them reaching for a treat? So I think that's a really cool aspect of it as well.
Yeah, and it becomes a game within the family. And what you find is the little girl has the best reliability by far. Next, it's a toss-up between the little boy and mum. Last will be dad. Dad will say more down commands. I mean, like another game, you know, bang. That's their homework. And then I said, right, I called two people out. It was a man and a little girl. I said, first doctor down. And the man's going down, 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 down. And the girl goes, bang, one bullet, you know, prone down, supine down. They're both downs. But the little girl gets the dog down instantly, and she's giggling. The man's repeating the command and is not happy, you know, because I put him on stage. And so as soon as we quantify or we test, it now becomes friendly competition within the family and for yourself. Now, training becomes like golf. I mean, why do you think golf is so seductive? Because it's impossible to conquer. But once you now, oh, wow, I'm par three on that hole. I've never done that before, you know? But then you're par four the next time you do it. It's what keeps us going, that we want to get that elusive perfect score. And they do exist, but only on a very short test. So, for example, an obedience competition, you'll get people that very rarely in their life got a perfect 200. Or a friend of mine got two perfect 200s back to back in Toronto, and she's going in the ring with her third dog. Why? She was a very good leash trainer, and then she discovered lure reward training. She's unbeatable now, just unbeatable. So it's fun, but people, they get all weirded out by testing. And I say, look on it as yoga. I just taken up yoga, by the way, for my shoulders and my balance. And I'm never going to perfect this. I know this now. This is an unsolvable task for me, but I'm getting my balance back. And my shoulders, there's some exercises I can't do because of my shoulders, but otherwise, you know, I'm getting more mobility in them and what have you. But it's unsolvable, and dog training and golf are kind of like that if you test. If you don't test, dog training is just an annoyance to many people, and that's a shame because they haven't, as you say, put the behavior on cue.
And I think before they test, they have to perfect that lure reward training. And that is one of the things that your new book talks about, correct?
I love the bits in it where, so step one is you phase out the lure. So now your dog is working, he's reading your hand signals and your verbal cues. Phase two is thinning down the food and using much better motivators, games, life rewards, and all sorts of things, praise. I recite nonsense poetry to dogs when they're healing nicely, or I hum because my singing is awful. But stage three is now you are enforcing without force, which this is a very interesting concept that you cue the dog. Number one, most of the time, I give an instruction like sit or come. I don't really mean it. It's a suggestion. Only very few instances you really must do it. because it's a safety thing, or it's a competition thing, or it's a show-off thing, whatever, you know. And this is very easy if you give the dog two names. A nickname signals the next word is a suggestion. And I'm actually surprised how many times my dogs follow my suggestions. I thought, I didn't really want you to come. I just wanted you a bit closer, you know, but they come all the way up to me. But if I really want them to do it, I call them by a different name. A lot of parents do this. They'll use a formal name with a child. Sadly, compliance or non-compliance is followed by a smack or something. No. The interesting thing that I found out since the 80s, I always thought you had to use a little volume. So you would say, Rover, sit. Rover, sit. Or it would be, you know, Hughie, sit. Hugo Louis, sit. But you don't. You don't have to change your volume or intonation at all. All that needs happen is if you use the formal name and say come or sit or down, it has to happen. And you keep repeating the command over and over, which of course is, wow, breaking the old, you never repeat the command they used to say, or else your dog will learn this and that. No, it doesn't. When you test it, the dog learns the meaning of the must-do command. How do we know that? Because the number of times you say, Hugo Louis, sit, decreases. But all you've done is followed up. Calmly, insistency, you explain to the dog, when I use your formal name, you must sit. And also, if you make me repeat the command, you have to repeat the entire exercise. So again, these are videos I was looking at me working with Dune. And Dune sit, and he didn't. So I had to repeat it and go up to him. And when he sits, I say, thank you. Then I take a step back, say, Dune, come. Dune, sit. Good boy, go play. You see that? So if the dog doesn't sit when you give a formal name, he has to sit the minimum twice now. So all the things they said about repeating commands is just incorrect. It's silliness. What are you going to do if your dog is chasing a low-flying seagull towards a cliff? Rover, sit. Oh, damn. I mean, it's ridiculous. Of course you repeat the command in an emergency, and I do it in learning too. It's no biggie. The dog is still learning. And what came out of actually writing the book, I couldn't verbalize this, is what we have is progressive consciousness of comprehension. So like a dog, it's not like he knows it or he doesn't. You can see a dog, like the stages of knowing it, like when you're teaching him to sit or distance commands, he doesn't do it. He doesn't sit up from the down or lie down from the stand, but he makes a little movement. Like his subconscious is saying, they want me to do something. And I sort of know what he's saying there, but not entirely. We're saying the same word as he does in the kitchen, sit, you know, or when the dog can't see your face. So it's wonderful getting videos of this. Then you can prove it to people that learning is a progressive process. And then once you get up to 97% is as far as you can get. Why? Well, I was going to say because dogs are human, but of course they aren't. They're canine. But humans are human, and there's no human that's perfect because we get distracted. We have daydreams. Our mind wanders. We forgot what we were doing, and we make mistakes. So now when you really ruthlessly calculate or quantify response reliability, 97 point something percent is the max on a long-term test. Yeah, the dog could do it right four or five times in a row, but I like to test, you know, at the minimum of 21 responses. I always do three reps of come, sit, stand, down, stand. Something like that. So that's 21 separate responses. And that's where we see 100% in, say, puppy two classes, but we don't see three tests of 100% in a row, say, and temperament. I mean, I love teaching manners obedience most, then solving behavior problems with words. A single word solves every problem when you've taught it on cue. But the temperament problems, you're always trying to mend a broken dog. And I find it upsetting.
You have so much value and so much information, which is why I was excited for this book for a long time.
It was a long time coming too. Like your research studies, I hope we're still working on them.
Absolutely. So for our listeners, Ian's new book, Barking Up the Right Tree, is now available. But I also want to go over where to find you. So where is the best place to find your current work? If you wanted to share those websites.
Oh, I had websites. They're all still up. Locally, of course, SiriusPup.com. DogStarDaily.com is still up and running, although we don't add to it so much now, but I'm going to revamp it. I'm going to put a lot of puppy pantomimes there. So a puppy pantomime is, there's one of them there. It's called Video Contest. So we gave them a title, Summer Fun, and we gave a massive prize, a lot of money. I'm embarrassed to say how much it is, so I won't. We won't be offering prizes like that again. But, the top five winners were exceptional. So puppy pantomime is, it's a little story, skit, joke, but the majority of the actors, it must be the majority, are dogs. And so it can be only a dog, or you've got, say, five dogs, but there's four people there as well. So you must have a majority of dogs acting. And then, of course, the big, that massive website is Dunbar Academy.com.
And all of these links will be alongside the episode for anyone listening. If you want to look for these links, I really appreciate your time. I normally ask at the end, what is the number one tip? But I don't want to ask you that because I just feel like you have so much value. We can't boil it down to one tip unless you want to share just one.
I would. I'd boil it down to two.
Okay.
Because these are things that upset me so much. So number one, prospective puppy owners must make absolutely certain that the breeder is socializing their pup to unfamiliar people. Don't worry, they'll catch up on the dog stuff in first week in puppy class. But not socializing to people is a life changer, quality of life changer for your dog and for you. It's just not much fun having a dog you can't walk or a dog you can't invite people over to your house without locking the dog up. So that is huge, and it's up to you. And this is my latest, I restarted this campaign. We call it Free Pup Books. And our goal is for anyone when they think about, oh, we'll get a puppy, must download these two free books first so we know what to expect and everything's rank ordered in terms of urgency and importance. That's number one, because not socializing, it's crippling for dogs and it's just not fair. Number two, make sure you read the pedigree. And there shouldn't be a male dog on the pedigree going back three generations that's less than 3 years of age. You can't judge a dog when it's 3 years old. It could have died of cancer at five, by which time, say, it won Westminster or Crufts and has sired, 500 puppies, which now may carry a gene that has a propensity for cancer. And this is what is happening to purebred dogs. And now it's beginning to influence mixed breeds as well, because, of course, mixed breeds, most of them were descended from purebred dogs at some time in their lineage, or maybe yesterday if they met a cute golden on the street. And now we're going to have 50% golden puppies. And so there's no point in them learning all the fun training if the dog wasn't socialized. There's no point in socializing and doing all the fun training if your dog's going to be dead at five or seven.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope this information was helpful. It's always a pleasure talking. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, MJ. And I apologize for not, for a few months now, I've been meaning to give you a call and I haven't done it. And I'm very remiss there, but I have been so busy. You know, this is the busiest year I've ever had in my life.
Well, you've been able to get a lot of work out there and a lot of value, and I'm really excited about that. Of course, I have already read the book, and I hope our listeners join me in that and enjoy this great information. So until next time, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for thinking of me. I'm very flattered. And thank you all out there. Can't see anyone and don't think anyone's out there at the moment, but you will be in the future, no doubt. But then I won't be here. So Thank you for listening. Please spread the word about the 2-3 Pup Books.
Thank you. Until next time.
Bye.